In the early 1990s, during my 3 years as a family practice resident, the residency doctors would all gather each Friday afternoon for an intensive dive into behavioral sciences, guided by adjunct faculty, a psychiatrist steeped in Jungian practice, and a psychologist who specialized in family systems theory. That work, and much more work since then, have informed nearly every aspect of my life, personal and professional. Those Friday afternoon sessions usually involved interviewing a patient carefully selected by the faculty, and we would be invited to use family systems theory to unfold to their experience with the backdrop of their family of origin as part of our study. And then after they left, we would reflect together on the encounter to learn more from it and about ourselves. The purpose was not to train us to be psychologists or psychiatrists, but it was to see that the persons we would treat as family doctors were not a reductive sum of body parts. A person would not present to my clinic with a bellyache, absent all the other elements of life around it, or a headache, or a body ache of some sort. Rather, we were to rely on the biopsychosocial spiritual model of medicine that seeks to serve humans and their ailments holistically. But I can tell you that residency was in a particularly stressful time of life, and the cumulative stressors for residents mean that we did not always comport to the holistic principles upon which family medicine stands, or the compassion which is demanded from it. There were times, sadly, that our Friday afternoon discussions after that patient exited turned to judgment for the person's ill-fated decisions in life, or to cynicism for the imperfect mental health system that had failed them. Sometimes humor was weaponized at a person's expense rather than serving as healing balm in the thicket of pain. Now, I share all of this for a purpose today as we wade deeper into the family saga of Genesis week by week now, turning today to the sibling rivalry between Jacob and Esau. I am convinced that the deeply seated wisdom of the scriptures is something akin to our modern notion of family systems theory. And I think that congruence has something to say about what is playing out on the stage of human experience in this day and time in our nation. If I were to summarize family systems theory, I would say this: that human beings function in a web of relationships to which we bring our emotional energy, recognized and unrecognized, and that most problems in the human condition are rooted in familial stories that stretch across generations. Left unaddressed, they will propagate into the generations to come. So, the mythic saga of Jacob and Esau shares the tale of two brothers who not only do not get along, but we are told that they breed the hatred into the generations that will follow them, Israelites and Edomites. This, even though they were twins out of the same womb. We know that their mother, Rebekah, played favorites. Surely Jacob and Esau knew this all too well, which would have made for some painfully challenging relationships between the two boys and their mother. Would the boys' relationship have been different had not Rebekah been so manipulative? We know the boys were born late in Isaac's life, a theme common to biblical stories where God is seen as the agent of holy purpose and possibility, We can imagine in that old age the seeds of pent-up anxiety and thrilled expectation, both sown into the gravid womb of an aging mother and into the tenuous circumstances of an aging father whose sight dims to a point he cannot recognize one boy from the other. He longs to bless them, each in their own right, even as Isaac's own childhood memory clearly recalls the dagger his own father Abraham held over his head and would have killed him but for a spare word from God. How must that experience have haunted Isaac for the rest of his life? How could it not inform his own fatherhood? Abraham's impulse to sacrifice his son Isaac, presumably at the direction of God, it makes no sense to us. But using a family systems cipher, how many family stories in our own time do we know where the father sacrificed his son's right to a good, safe life on the altar of alcohol, or on the altar of relentless put-downs, or on the altar of unattainable expectations of success? It's no surprise when the son conveys that pain and sorrow to the next generation. We're told Jacob was a trickster, a man bent on devious means to get ahead. It's bad enough here in this passage today, coaxing his brother's birthright out of him when he's hungry. It gets more interesting from here, and more disturbing, and more destructive. But surely we can say Jacob did not become a man of deceit on his own in a vacuum. He was formed and influenced by the haunted landscape of his family saga, generation to generation. All of it, good and bad, sown into the confluence of his life and the expectations he and others have of him. And from there, Jacob sows the seeds into the next generation that include 12 sons whose story is as brilliant and terrifying as any story I've ever known. And yet, God still uses all of them. Broken and imperfect as they are, God uses them for good. Now, I hope with all of that, I've maybe whet your appetite at least a little to read the story straight through Genesis, beginning with chapter 12. Folks, it is family systems writ large and small for us as we try to make sense of our own lives here and now. And the truth to be told is there is truth for our time here. I believe with all my heart there is an invitation to compassion that lies deep in the soil of this story, ready to bear fruit in our own lives if we will just allow it to germinate in our hearts. But for that to happen, we must ask God, we must ask, where is God in all of this, in all of this? How might God use for good that which was meant for evil? I suppose when so much seems to be going awry, it's human in nature to incline to judgment and cynicism rather than compassion, to use a moral calculus in which a person is either good or a person is evil, a binary system, a dualism. But it's a slippery slope from there, quickly leads us to consider jettisoning a person altogether because of the heinous acts that they've committed. Translated, a person who does evil is evil. Do we really believe that? To be sure, moral judgment serves a purpose. as we differentiate a good act from a bad one. But that in and of itself is a two-dimensional analysis in a three-dimensional world that invites a compassionate eye to strain through the superficial gloss of quick judgment down into the contoured experience of life seated in the merciful womb of God's belovedness for all. For all. And so I stand here this morning and ask you, is there anyone whom we would say is not our brother or our sister or our sibling in God's family system, enthused with redemptive love? Is there anyone? My friends, in recent weeks, this nation has embarked on important work of questioning our history as handed down to us, historic traditions that in large part are aimed at preserving myths of supremacy upon which this nation stands so precariously now. In a way, this is family systems work as well, with the seeds of today's woes sown across the generations of this nation. This work of dealing with our history with authenticity, this work only makes sense in a biopsychosocial spiritual model of relationality. And we need to rewrite the narratives informed by truth gleaned from multiple perspectives, especially those too long silenced. So I want to be clear. The Confederate monuments erected a century ago across this nation in this city, standing as altars to the sacrifice-hungry idols of racial fear and oppression, must come down, and this church will stand in support of that work. We must learn from those evil impulses, lest we be destined to repeat the sad history. But in the same breath, I implore us all, let us take great care in our work that's extrapolated from there as we rewrite the glorified and unquestioned histories of men and women who have been regarded as heroes of this nation. We can learn the truth of their lives without redacting their lives from our histories altogether. To redact them from our family saga will, I fear, leave us with gaping holes in our collective psyche, holes which we will want to fill with something, anything, no matter how destructive it may be. That's how addictions form. And to be sure, nations can have addictions just as individuals do. Oh my God, that could be a whole nother sermon, the addictions of America. Suffice it to say here, though, that some among us have suffered terribly because of the ways we've told our family stories. Secrets are toxic to family systems. And God knows our nation has held its share of secrets. We can call them lies. It is time to set aside that approach. It is time to live differently. But we must take care not to be diverted by moral shortcuts that recklessly apply the labels of good and evil as summary judgments, not just on the actions of people, but on the people themselves, those living today or those from generations past. Because the truth is, folks, if we are honest, we all know deep down that we each have the capacity for good and we each have the capacity for evil. And even still, we trust that God can use it all for good. Some of our ancestors won't be very likable. Some of our siblings will do awful things. But we know we live in a family system that has probably hurt them too. And with that knowledge, maybe we can claim our vocation of compassion for them and for those they hurt and for us also, even as we work for a better, more whole world as we do. Because at the end of the day, we were all knit together in the womb of God's tender love and mercy. As followers of Jesus, in this auspicious time, do we really believe that? Are we willing to stake our lives on it?